This is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. On the second evening of the convention, Democrats are making the case that President Obama accomplished plenty in his first term and that he deserves a second term to see his vision through. President Clinton will formally nominate Mr. Obama this evening in the biggest speech of the night. Before that, we'll hear from the popular Democratic candidate Elizabeth Warren, who is facing a tough race in Massachusetts. I'm joined now by NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving and E.J. Dionne from the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Ron, we heard the Delaware Governor Jack Markell say that, look, just because Mitt Romney has this great successful business experience doesn't qualify him to be president. I keep trying to think back of businessmen presidents, and all I can think of is Herbert Hoover. Can you shed light on the history of businessmen in office?
Herbert Hoover was many things, a businessman. He was an engineer. He was something of a geologist and a miner, and also had been an extraordinarily successful government official as a part of the cabinet that dealt with all of the destruction of World War I and all that had to be done to bring Europe back after that. And it was largely on the strength of that he was elevated to the presidency. But he probably has been mostly associated with the business side because of that identification and because that has been so much the focus of the Republican Party in the 90 years since he was president. So there is always, if you will, a kind of presumption that more of that that is among conservatives and business people and Republicans, that if we could run government more like a business, that's a phrase we've heard many times, if we could run government more like a business, we'd all be better off, and that businesses could not run up the kind of debt that the public sector runs up. And that is certainly a potent argument and part of the great American debate. But what Jack Markell was saying was just because Mitt Romney was highly successful as a businessman by moving money around between countries and by moving jobs wherever it was most efficient for profit does not mean that he could necessarily deal with the panoply of goods and requirements and demands that a president has to deal with in the public sector. So that's always where the argument is joined. Is great success in the private sector an indication that someone would be equally successful running the whole show, the public sector as well?
All right. E.J. Oh, okay. E.J. Dionne or Mara, feel free to jump in. It's a tricky argument to make, though, sort of saying, yes, businessmen, okay, fine, but no. We don't want you in government.
It is unfortunate that the last successful businessman president happened to preside over the Great Depression, which is not helpful to Romney. It's worth noting that one of my favorite presidents, Harry Truman, had an unsuccessful haberdashery business and then went into politics. I think the issue is that a businessman does not have to bring people together in quite the same way as a president does, because he has enormous unchallenged authority and you don't have the division of powers. And the other is he is only interested in profit, whereas a president has to be interested in job creation for everyone, in social welfare, in the people who aren't necessarily as successful but would like to be more successful. So it's a different job description. Some businessmen are successful in politics. Markell is a good governor, and he's a businessman. But I think some of the habits you develop as a businessman and business person may not always be compatible with being a small-D Democratic leader.
Yes, Mara, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when you talk to the White House about this, one of their big goals was to knock the businessman's halo off of Romney. Businessmen, at least in the beginnings of their campaigns, generally get a kind of benefit of the doubt. And I think the whole argument of the Obama campaign has been trying to show why the skills that are useful in making a lot of profits for your investors are not useful if you're trying to raise the great mass of American people up into prosperity.
Mm. Can I change the topic a bit? Bill Clinton's is the big speech tonight, and there's been a lot written in the past week about his relationship with Mr. Obama. It has not always been very good. Has it evolved? What do we know about these two men's relationship?
Well, I think. Oh, go ahead, Mara. Do you want to go? What I was going to.
The Yeah, go ahead, EJ. I'll follow up after you.
Oh, I was just going to say, obviously the relationship wasn't great in the primaries because Barack Obama was running against Hillary Rodham Clinton. And President Clinton had some moments, particularly in the South Carolina primary, that that were not helpful to the relationship. And that there were things he said that some chose to interpret in racial terms. And sort of the relationship really hit the rocks. Since then, the relationship has improved in a number of ways. First, Hillary Clinton is now the Secretary of State in the Obama administration. Second, Obama has turned to Clinton for advice and does seem to realize that Bill Clinton is one of the best politicians our country has ever created, and Obama knows he really needs Clinton tonight. And it always improves a relationship when one side feels the other side realizes that you're needed. And I think that's so I think it's changed substantially since the primary campaign 4 years ago.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And not only have they gone golfing together, but President Obama even brought Bill Clinton into the briefing room once and then left him there to answer questions for 45 minutes to reporters. So I think
it takes a big ego to do that. Yes, a lot of confidence to do that.
Yes, a lot of confidence to do that. And so I don't think that he's worried about President Obama, former President Clinton upstaging him or somehow going off the reservation to do something that benefits him and Hillary more than Obama. I think that they are really united here. And the fact that you see President Clinton starring in those Obama campaign ads, they see him as a pretty unalloyed asset for them.
Okay, well, you bring that up, but just, you know, because we are talking politics and, people have wondered if Hillary Clinton will have another run for the presidency in 2016, and that leads to the question, well, could Bill Clinton help her tonight? Just to
the
be
cynical.
The answer
is yes.
There's certainly no reason to think that anything that Bill Clinton can do tonight to help Barack Obama would be any detriment to the future of Hillary Clinton. Most people expect her to retire as Secretary of State this winter, no matter who wins the presidential race, and then explore whether or not she wants to run again for president at the age of 69, as she would be in 2016. She may well decide to do it. And if she does, I don't think there's any question Bill Clinton will be a huge asset, and very possibly, if this alliance can be pushed further, Barack Obama could be a huge asset for her as well.
Clinton being here is good for Hillary's campaign. If Hillary's campaign happens, there's no doubt about it.
Well, we'll have many years to talk about all that. Right now at the podium there in Charlotte, Kamala Harris. She's the Attorney General of California, the first woman, first African-American, and first South Asian Attorney General of California.
And those are the rules Mitt Romney would have us roll back. He would roll back the rules that protect the air we breathe and the water we drink. Roll back the rules that protect the health and safety of women and families. Roll back the rules that prevent the kind of recklessness that got our economy into this mess in the first place. Well, I've seen all that happens when you roll back those rules. What happens are rows of foreclosure signs. What happens are mountains of family debt. What happens is a middle class that's hurting. That's what we've seen in towns across California and across this country. When it comes to the housing crisis, the choice between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney is clear. The fact is, we don't have to guess what Mitt Romney would have done if he were president, because he told us. He said we should let foreclosures, and I quote, hit the bottom. So the market could, I quote, run its course. Run its course. That's not leadership. Doing nothing while the middle class is hurting, that's not leadership. Loose regulations and lax enforcement, that's not leadership. That's abandoning our middle class. Here's what President Obama did. President Obama won Wall Street reform to prevent any more tax-funded bailouts. President Obama won credit card reform so you don't get stuck with hidden fees and sudden rate hikes.
All right, we've been listening to Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of California. She was saying that Mitt Romney would roll back the rules on the environment, economic regulation, and other measures that would lead to hardship for average people. Now NPR's Sonari Glinton is on the floor of the convention. Hi, Sonari.
Hey, Jennifer. I'm here with former Massachusetts governor and former presidential nominee Michael Dukakis. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
What do you think that President Clinton needs to do this evening?
Do what he always does. Do a great job. You know, he and, it turns out, Michelle Obama, two of the very few people who can speak conversationally to several million Americans. She was terrific last night, and he's great, and he's going to be great.
What advice would you give to the president on his speech tomorrow?
Well, remember, he won twice and I lost, so maybe I shouldn't be giving him that. I think he's got to do three things. First, he's got to remind people of who created this mess. You know, I'm a Depression baby, and I remember FDR reminding us over and over again about Hoover Economics and what created the Great Depression. People have short memories, and it's very important that the president help people understand just what a mess these folks made and how this Republican ticket wants to go back and do the same thing all over again. Secondly, he's got to lay out his statement for the future, what he wants to do. And thirdly, he's got to tell the American people about Mitt Romney's economic record in Massachusetts, which was a disaster. I mean, we were the fourth worst state economy in the country, 47th out of 50 in job growth. And that's something people have to know, because the idea that Romney is qualified to provide economic leadership in this country based on what we saw in Massachusetts is preposterous. And that's a story that has to be told.
Well, thank you so much, Governor Dukakis.
Okay.
I appreciate
that.
Back to you, Jennifer.
Sonari Glinton, thank you so much. Ron Elving, you know, it reminded me of, with Mr. Dukakis there, I was thinking about the state of campaigning and the commercials that we're seeing. We all remember the Willie Horton ad during the that kind of damaged Mr. Dukakis' candidacy there, and I'm just wondering about a little reflection here on things haven't changed so much, or is it even worse?
I think if you look back at 1988 and the Willie Horton ad, it stood out and we all remember it, partly because it was so much nastier and seemed so much more of a low blow than anything else in the campaign. But here was the thing about it that was prescient or predictive. It was not run by the campaign of George H.W. Bush. Against Mike Dukakis. It was run by an independent group. And at that time, that was considered to be a bit exotic, a bit unusual, something that was a bit outre, outside the rules. Now, it is the campaign. Now, the two campaigns are increasingly eclipsed by these enormous money machines, these shadow groups, whatever you want to call them, that can raise money in some cases without limit and without even revealing who the donors are and put on ads of any kind that the candidate himself or herself doesn't really have any control.
And we keep hearing about President Obama mentioning maybe a constitutional amendment to make that not legal anymore. Is that just talk or is that possible?
Well, it's not possible probably to address everything that has gone awry with our campaign finance and advertising system with any one single measure, but probably the beginning would be to address the Supreme Court decisions that go all the way back to the 1970s that say money is speech. Anytime you're spending money, you're exercising your right of free speech, and that any kind of inhibition of your ability to spend money in a political campaign is somehow limiting your right of free speech under the First Amendment. That would need to be addressed before all these other more recent cases in the federal courts, including Citizens United and you know, Right to Life Wisconsin, some of these other cases that have changed all the rules and widened the ability of millionaires and billionaires to influence politics with enormous contributions, sometimes in secret.
Although earlier Supreme Court decisions did not take a full money is speech view, the earlier decisions before Citizens United allowed the Congress to put some limits on some of these activities. I think a constitutional amendment is a very hard thing to get. There are new proposals around that are designed to create big incentives for candidates to raise small money, like a 5-to-1 match for all contributions of $200 or under. To me, the way to democratize money is to have small money flood out the big money. But in the meantime, particularly on the Republican side, because it's worth noting that the Republicans have raised a lot more of this secret money or dark money, as people call it, some people call it, than the Democrats have. And there's a real problem with a lack of accountability in all of these groups.
Mara Liasson, you've been covering politics a long time. Is it making that much? How much difference is it making out there?
You're talking about the money? How much the super PAC money? Oh, it's making a tremendous difference. I don't think we've heard this over and over again, but there's never been an incumbent president who's been outspent by his challenger. That's happening this time. I think that when you add up the number of truly undecided voters in the 8 or 10 swing states that the money is being concentrated in, and it's probably about no more than 2 or 3 million people. And I haven't done the math, but if a couple $1 billion is being spent mostly on them, each of those undecided voters is getting the equivalent of an unbelievable amount of money aimed at persuading them.
Well, we see a lot of those commercials in the D.C. market from Virginia, I guess.
Yes,
it's
from Virginia.
Incessant.
And the other thing that's interesting is the premise of the Citizens United decision is that if speech is money, that means if you have more money, you get to have more speech. And it's definitely elevated these individual billionaires who can kind of ride on the campaign planes of the candidates. And, I think it increases cynicism about politics. And there's no doubt that the playing field is now tilted to people who have incredibly deep pockets and choose to spend them on politics.
Well, and in this case, that would mean the Republicans in many races, certainly at the presidential level, right?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, but the impact is much bigger down ballot. I think that generally presidential candidates can raise what they need to. I think the impact is going to be much larger on Senate, House, and down ballot candidates. And there are some people who think that it will give a structural advantage to Republicans in Congress for years and years to come.
So what do you make of talk of trying to change this by a constitutional
amendment? I think that will be very difficult.
All right.
I just want to underscore, I agree with everything Mara said, and it's particularly in the congressional races and the Senate races that we're really going to see the power of this dark money.
All right. We are waiting to hear from a woman who's been called the Hispanic Oprah. Christina Saralegui is being introduced in Charlotte. She is obviously targeting the Hispanic audience. And I believe she's coming out on stage now. She is the host of a weekly talk show on Sirius XM Radio. She has come out in favor of President Obama. She stars in a Spanish language ad for him. Christina Saralegui.
Wow. Oh, my God. Wasn't that something? Muchas gracias, Benita. And muchas gracias to all the dreamers, all the young kids that study and do their homework. Bueno, like most Latinas, you know that I'm not afraid to speak my mind. Through the years, I've asked very tough people some very tough questions. I have tackled big issues on live TV, but one thing I have never done until now was get involved in politics. No, Dios mío. But this year is very different. If 2008 was an important election, nothing compared to 2012. Nothing. Thank you. Like Benita, I know what it's like to come to this country at a young age. I was 12 years old when, like so many Cubans, my parents fled the Castro regime. Viva Cuba. For us, America meant freedom. America was the place that said, it don't matter where you come from, it doesn't matter what your last name is, it doesn't matter if you drink cortaditos or latte or café con leche, coffee with milk. Here, if you work very hard, anything is possible. And that's what I did, sí se puede. Even though I could not afford to finish college, I got an internship job in Vanidades magazine, And I turned that internship into a job, and that job into a business, and a television show, El Show de Cristina, that ended up with 100 million viewers in 40 different countries. Thank you. Si se puede. Si se puede. For me, muchas gracias. For me, que si se puede, caray. For me, the American promise, because it's not just a dream, it's a promise, isn't just an idea, it's not a theory, it's my life story and of many dreamers. I want to pass that promise on to my grandchildren, Dominic and Christina Maria. I want them to grow up in the kind of country I grew up in.
We're listening to Christina Sara Legge, known as the Hispanic Oprah.
Mi gente, mi gente. For the first time in my life, the first time in my life, the promise of America is in danger. Nearly every part of Governor Romney's plan we put that American dream further out of reach. In order to cut taxes for those at the very top, he would raise taxes for middle-class families, slash education, and cut student aid. Governor Romney would turn Medicare from a guarantee into una libreta de cupones, a book of coupons. He would repeal health care reform, forcing millions of Hispanics to lose insurance. Governor Romney's plan is really just one word, patra, backward. We need to move forward, pa'lante, pa'lante. We need to re-elect our President Obama. Our president is an incredible man. He fights for us every single day. He helped prevent a second Great Depression. He cut taxes from middle-class families and small businesses. He fought for health care reform, which is already helping millions of Americans afford insurance. His education policies mean Hispanics will receive an estimated 150,000 more college scholarships. He is on our side. Yes. And he knows we still have a lot of work to do. President Obama has a detailed plan. You can find this plan right on his website. It's a plan to grow our economy from the middle class out and the bottom up, not from the top down. A plan to invest in education, a plan to invest in manufacturing, and a plan to pass comprehensive immigration reform that includes a path to citizenship. Thank you. On immigration, Governor Romney's views, this really freaked me out. His views could not be more extreme. He says that we should make life so unbearable for 11 million people that they simply self-deport. What is that? He said that Arizona's immigration law should be a model for our country. Don't boo, vote. Okay. He even made the architect of that horrible law an immigration advisor for his campaign. That was really smart. No protesting, voting, vote. And of course, he has promised to repeal the DREAM Act. This election is about many things. But if you want to understand the values of the two candidates, all you have to do is think about Benita, the beautiful lady that introduced me tonight. Governor Romney calls young people like her, at 27, illegal aliens. President Obama calls them dreamers. And that is the difference in this election. So, in closing, I'm asking toda mi gente, all of my people, to please join me. Many of us come from countries where votes are not counted properly. In fact, they're not counted at all. Here, we Latinos have a very powerful voice, but only if we use it. That begins with making sure you are registered to vote. So I want you to go to gotavote.com, and in Spanish, that's votemostodos.com. They have everything you need to get registered. Make sure your friends and family are registered too. And Charlotte, let me ask you a question, girlfriend. ¿Estás con nosotros, Charlotte? Are you in? Will you register voters? Will you talk to your family and friends? Will you fight for that dream we all believe in? Will you keep the promise of this country alive? Estamos unidos. Let's do this together. Pa'lante, pa'lante, pa'atrás, ni pa' coger impulso. Muchas gracias. Thank you very much.
And that was Cristina Sara Legge. She's a former talk show host from Univision and Telemundo. She's often called the Hispanic Oprah. Said she's never gotten involved in politics before, but she says, for the first time in my life, the promise of the American dream is in danger. She called Mitt Romney's budget backward and praised President Obama for health care reform, for offering more college scholarships for Hispanics, and supporting comprehensive immigration reform. On the floor there in Charlotte, NPR's Debbie Elliott. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Jennifer. I am in really good seats right down front with the Colorado delegation, and I found a couple of women here who had some very interesting headdresses, so I decided to sit down and talk to them, and they are on their feet. They are so excited. I've got Halisi Vinson and Angie Dickinson with me. Ms. Dickinson, what are you looking forward to most this evening?
Well, this whole night has been so inspirational and really getting us fired up, but it's really just getting us ready for President Bill Clinton. And I'm telling you, I'm pretty sure the walls are going to rumble in this house tonight, because Bill Clinton is really going to get us fired up, and he's going to really just let everybody know that we need to build the middle class from the middle class out and not from the top down, because that's what he did when he was president, and that's what President Barack Obama believes in as an American value as well, is building from the middle class out.
Now, you all are both from Denver. Ms. Benson, you know, Colorado is in play this year. That's why you have such great seats here. What needs to happen to, what do you think you need to do as a delegate and as a Democrat to turn out the vote in that state?
Well, I think, you know, as a person who's on the ground and the Get Out the Vote coordinator for my House district, there's a couple of things we need to do. One is we need to let inactive voters or voters know that they might be inactive if they did not vote in 2010. So if they're expecting a mail-in ballot, they might not get one, okay? And then they've got to show up to the polls with the right kind of identification. If you get a letter from Scott Gessler, you know, you need to call the county clerk's office and get it straightened out.
But do you think people are excited?
I think people are very excited, and Colorado will go for Barack Obama in 2012. You can believe that.
Jennifer, you can hear the excitement here. People getting ready for the big speech this evening.
Well, Debbie, let me ask you, talked about the headdresses there. What kind of get-ups are you seeing? What's the atmosphere there?
Well, one, we've got a cowboy hat with President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden on the front. And then we have a red, white, and blue and black feather net. I don't know. What do you call that?
It's a fascinator, a European side hat.
There you have it. Out of my fashion league, I'm afraid.
Okay, fine. And Debbie, you're with the Colorado delegation. They've heard from their governor tonight. Do they see him as a rising star in the Democratic Party?
I think they do, and I think they are hoping that that state can really make a difference in the campaign this year. Immigration is a big issue in Colorado. A lot of the people on their feet here when there was conversation going on about the DREAM Act and allowing students to go to college and not be deported if they were brought here as a child from a country illegally. So I think a lot of the themes and a lot of the issues that are being hit on here this evening are the kind of issues that are going to resonate in Colorado.
All right, Debbie Elliott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we have a video now, another video playing down there in Charlotte about the auto industry. Let's listen in.
U.S. auto industry is in dire straits.
Reports showed manufacturing activity hitting a 26-year low last month.
Things happened real fast. Banks started falling into trouble. No one's going to buy a car in that kind of a climate. So I started seeing a layoff here, a layoff there. It just was a domino effect from there.
Automakers are desperately waiting for a lifeline while thousands of workers in all sorts of industries are losing their livelihoods.
If I don't go to work anymore, the five or six suppliers around us all go away. The gas stations all around here go away. The grocery stores close. In the span of less than a year, you know, a place like Lansing would be a ghost town.
Nobody knew what the future held. I was living from paycheck to paycheck, and that paycheck was an unemployment check from the state of Michigan.
We were on pins and needles watching every day, waiting. Please, please help us.
The nation's struggling automakers say that they need a loan to keep them from bankruptcy.
The president faces a staggering array of tough decisions.
It was a very, very unpopular thing to do at the time. Caught flak from all directions.
It will come as no surprise that some Americans who've suffered the most during this recession have been those in the auto industry. We cannot and must not, and we will not, let our auto industry simply vanish.
I remember the day that President Obama came on TV and said that he was going to grant the auto loans. I sit up off the couch and was like, oh my God, we're getting our loans.
I'll never forget, my kids and I were all sitting here and we just hugged and I screamed and we all danced around like fools. So mommy's going back to work.
President Obama gave us the tools and we ran with it. So when we came back to work, we had a fire to do well, a fire to get it done, a fire to be a big company again.
Good evening. It worked. That's what the president said as he saluted the official return of America's auto industry.
We came back just with a vengeance.
Auto sales topped estimates in June.
As of tonight, General Motors is back on top.
What a proud moment for us. We came from the scariest moment in our life to the most triumphant.
The day that Chrysler paid back the loans, it was one of the proudest moments that I've had working at Chrysler because everybody worked together. From the CEOs down to the janitors to make our company survive.
We made a promise. Made a promise to the country, made a promise to the president, and we were gonna make good on it.
Don't bet against the American worker. Don't bet against the American people.
To me, a leader is someone that actually hears the people and is not afraid to work for the people. And I think President Obama proved that from what he's done for us.
He showed the kind of leadership and character that's required in a president that will do what's best for the group and not necessarily himself.
Since I've been back to work, I've seen new businesses sprout up all around the plant. So we do good, everybody does good.
Are you better now than when you were 4 years ago? Yes, we are better. And we're going to be even better if we keep on going with what we've got going right now, and that's President Obama.
All right, a video there on President Obama's bailout of the auto industry. They showed a picture of a Mitt Romney op-ed entitled Let Detroit Go Bankrupt, and that was brought a big boo from the audience. And Pierre Sonari Glinton is on the floor now with the Michigan delegation. Hi, Sonari.
Hey, Jennifer. I'm on the floor with the Michigan delegation, as you said. And there's several people. It's getting really loud here. There are several people crying in the delegation. What's interesting is that when you think about the auto bailout, you would think that Michigan and Ohio, where auto jobs are really important, you think that the president would run away with those states, but it isn't, because in places like Michigan, there are a lot of people who have been against the bailout, who live alongside auto workers. I'm here. I've been talking to people from Ford and General Motors, who all say. That they don't know what they would have done if two-thirds of the auto industry had gone away. And so I'm with the auto worker right now who works at Ford. Tell us your name.
Andrew Linko.
And you were saying to me earlier that you thought that it was You explained to me why you thought that the bailout was so important. As a Ford worker, you work at the Ford stamping plant?
Yes, that's correct. We share a lot of the second and third tier suppliers with the General Motors and Chrysler, as well as the foreign manufacturers. And if those companies would have went out of business, their suppliers would have went out of business because they had very tight margins to operate with. So it would have affected all three car companies, and it would have devastated the Michigan economy, because for every one auto job, there's five supporting jobs. And we've already had a recession, and without the loans to support both industries and keep them going, Michigan would have never turned around. Today we're hiring. Our plants are hiring 1,200 workers. All our plants that were scheduled to close are now reopened, and we just reported double-digit sales with all three of them.
Why do you think that there are so many Michiganders who are against the bailout, who did agree with Governor Rauner?
I think they were listening to the majority of the media, especially to Fox Network, saying that it's your money, it's a bailout, it's socialism and that. But take in consideration over the years, I originally worked in the steel industry, and for years the foreign manufacturers were receiving bailouts from their respective countries and dumping the products on our economy at a lower price. Now we're asking is to save our industry and save our economy. And our President Barack Obama has done that, and that's why we need to keep him in office for another 4 years.
There are a lot of your co-workers here. All right, and here comes, coming to the stage is Bob King. He's the president of UAW, who came to the UAW in 2010.
Being loudly cheered there in the Michigan delegation. And Pierre Sonari-Glinton, thank you so much. Bob King, president of the United Auto Workers, now in Charlotte.
Was Margaret Chase Smith, and she said, the right way is not always the popular and the easy way. Standing for right when it's unpopular is a true test of moral character. Margaret Chase Smith was a Republican, but a very different kind than those Republicans trying to overtake our country now. In some of America's darkest economic days since the Great Depression, and in the face of tremendous political venom, President Obama met the test of moral character. He stood up not for what was popular and easy, but for what was right. He stood for and with American workers, not just auto workers, but a million workers in towns all across America, who, if the industry went under, would not be able to put food on the table. We all remember what those days were like when President Obama took office. Workers waiting anxiously as their companies announced layoffs. Banks refusing to loan. Car sales were collapsing. It wasn't just auto companies that were struggling to survive. So were those companies making parts and selling cars. Small businesses that relied on auto workers as customers, like diners and barbershops, had to close down. Unfortunately, most Republicans advocated doing nothing. And what did Mitt Romney say? You all know this. He said, let Detroit go bankrupt.
This is special coverage of the Democratic National Convention from NPR News.
In strong contrast, President Obama took action, putting together a rescue team, demanding real change and real sacrifice from everyone involved, from management, from labor, from suppliers, from debt holders, from dealers, everybody involved. It was not universally popular, but it was absolutely right. President Obama's strong leadership saved a million jobs. Since June of 2009, this industry has added a quarter of a million jobs, and the auto industry is thriving again. These are good middle-class jobs in glass, in plastics, in steel. Jobs making things for an economy built to last. And Mitt Romney's record at Bain Capital, the corporate buyout firm he founded, too often has made their money not by building companies up, but by taking them apart. And too often, the workers ended up in the streets, even as Romney and his partners made millions of dollars. Earlier this week, we celebrated Labor Day. Many people forget what this holiday and why it was created, what this holiday is. It was about safe workplaces, health care, the 40-hour work week, middle-class jobs, standards that all of us believe in. But these standards did not just happen. They happened because generations of working people fought for, and in some cases died for, the right to organize and the right to collectively bargain. President Obama strongly supports these basic human rights because these rights are good for all Americans. Strong unions and collective bargaining.
And we've been listening to Bob King, president of the United Auto Workers Union, praising President Obama's strong leadership, which he says saved a million jobs in the auto industry. We're joined now by Senator Mark Warner, senator from Virginia, also a former governor of that state. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on.
The economy is obviously a big issue tonight and in the campaign in general. Tell us why you think President Obama, has he been a good steward of the economy?
I think he has. Let me give you three reasons. One, if you look at where we were 4 years ago, with us losing 750,000 jobs a month, with net total loss of 8 million jobs, where the stock market was at 7,000, where we're on the precipice of a total worldwide financial meltdown, and see where we are today, 29 months straight of private sector job growth, 4 million new jobs, stock market at 13,000. And on a relative basis compared to the rest of the world, America looks pretty darn good.
And yet, is that hard to make, on an individual basis? While that may be true for the nation, individuals may feel kind of worse off now than a few years ago. The things have sunk in and there's been a rolling impact.
But if the question is, where do we go from here, or where have we been, I think on that kind of point of bringing back that factual basis is important, number one. But I think your point is, too, is where do we go from here? You know, I was a business guy for long before I was a governor or a senator. I was a business guy for 20 years plus. If you're going to invest in a business, you have three basic criteria, and that's what I did. I started companies. One was you invest in your workforce. Second is you invest in plant and equipment. And third thing you do is you try to make sure you stay ahead of the competition. Countries do the same thing. And if you looked at how a country gets ahead and has a good business plan, you invest in your invest in your workforce. You go ahead and invest in the equivalent of plant and equipment, which is infrastructure, roads, bridges, tunnels, broadband, and you try to stay ahead of your competition in terms of research and development. If you look at the Ryan Romney business plan, which is laid out in the Ryan Romney budget, they cut those investments by more than three quarters. I don't know what country could compete in the 21st century if you took the Romney business plan, which would cut federal investment in education, workforce training, infrastructure, and R&D to less than 5%. I can tell you this much. Brazil, China, India, even Europe, with all its problems, are going to have a stronger business plan than what he's put forward. I think pointing that out and also pointing out that this president has continued to invest in education, whether it is in Pell Grants, education reform, high-speed rail, research and development in terms of energy research, biotech, additional movement forward in terms of IT. These are all things that we have to continue if we're going to stay competitive. And I think that business case, and as somebody who's, as I mentioned, been longer as a business guy than a political guy, and I'd match my business credentials against anybody on the Republican side, that business plan they've got versus the business plan that the president's got, that contrast hasn't been drawn clearly enough, and I hope the president will try to make that point tomorrow night.
All right. Senator Mark Warner from Virginia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Now at the podium in Charlotte, we have three former employees at companies that were controlled by Mitt Romney's Bain Capital. We're hearing Randy Johnson, Cindy Hewitt, and David Foster.
Let's and listen. 7 months later, they closed our plant for good. What affected me most was having guys the age I am now come to my desk and cry. Guys who had nothing to fall back on. I don't think Mitt Romney's a bad man. I don't fault him for the fact that some companies win and some companies lose. That's a fact of life. What I fault him for is making money without a moral compass. I fault him for putting profits before people like me. But that's just Romney economics. America cannot afford Romney economics. Mitt Romney will stick it to working people. Barack Obama sticking up for working people. It's simple as that. That's why I'm supporting him for a second term as president.
When Mitt Romney first announced he was running for president, I had no idea who he was. But then I learned he was the CEO of Bain Capital, and that sure got my attention real fast. I used to work at a plant in Miami that Governor Romney bought with his partners from Bain. I say used to because not long after they bought it, Romney and his partners shut our plant down and ultimately drove our company into bankruptcy. Our company, Dade Bearing, was a big part of our community. There were folks who'd been at the plant for 15 to 20 years. But by the time Romney and his partners were done with us, we'd lost 850 jobs in Florida. It was a really difficult time for me and for my coworkers, but not for Governor Romney and his partners. While we watched our jobs disappear, they ultimately walked away with more than $240 million. Of course, I understand some companies are successful, others are not. That's the way our economy works. But it is wrong when dedicated, productive employees feel the pain while folks like Mitt Romney make profits. So, when Mitt Romney talks about his business experience, remember, it is not experience creating good-paying jobs. It is experience cutting jobs. It is experience shutting plants. It is experience making millions of dollars by making life tougher for hardworking Americans. That is not the kind of experience we need in the White House. We need a president who will create good-paying jobs and make sure everyone has a fair chance. We need President Barack Obama.
Good evening. Good evening. And a special greeting to my fellow Minnesotans and to the hardworking Missourians that I was privileged to represent for so many years. I'm David Foster, and I was a steel worker for 31 years. For 15 years, I laid brick and tapped the furnaces and did all that hard, dirty work that turned molten metal into the cars and bridges and buildings that make America what it is today. And I also led the steelworkers in a 13-state region, including GST Steel in Kansas City, a 100-year-old company that was bought by Mitt Romney and his partners at Bain Capital in 1993. Now, it's a story that I wish I didn't have to tell, but America needs to know the truth. When Romney and Bain took over the mill, they loaded it up with millions in debt. And within months, they used some of that borrowed money to pay themselves millions. Within a decade, the debt kept growing and was so large the company was forced into bankruptcy. They fired 750 steel workers while they pocketed $12 million in profits. A steel worker at GST would have had to work 240 years to make $12 million. So in 2001, with GST bankrupt and Romney still CEO of Bain, I had to stand in a rented auditorium in front of hundreds of steel workers in their 50s and 60s, retirees and widows in their 70s and 80s, and tell them Romney and Bain had broken their promises. Jobs, vacation pay, severance, health insurance, pension benefits that were promised, they were all gone. Now, some companies succeed. Some companies succeed, others fail. I know that. But I also know this. We don't need a president who fires steelworkers or says, let Detroit go bankrupt. We need the leadership. We need the leadership of a man who, during the darkest hours for America's auto industry, rolled up his sleeves, risked his presidency, and saved over 1 million good auto jobs. We need Barack Obama. Thank you.
And we've been listening to three former employees at companies that were controlled by Romney's Bain Capital. They said they understand some win, some lose. But one man said, I fault Mitt Romney for making money without a moral compass and putting profits before people like me. Now we're going to listen to Chris Van Hollen. He's a congressman from Maryland, also the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee. He'll also be playing Paul Ryan in mock debates with Vice President Biden. Here's Chris Van Hollen.
For Vice President. He's the chairman of the House Budget Committee. I lead the Democrats on the committee. We have sharp differences over policy, but we get along well. And I'll admit, I was glad Paul was picked. I hoped it would result in a serious debate about the choice before us. Then I heard his acceptance speech. It kept the fact-checkers up all night. You remember the Republicans had this gigantic clock in the arena showing the size of the national debt. And Paul told America, if you elect Republicans, we can fix that. But if Paul Ryan was being honest, he would have pointed to that debt clock and said, we built that. Because here are the facts. When President Clinton left office, America had a projected surplus of trillions of dollars over the next decade. Then came two wars, two tax cuts tilted to the wealthy, and a new entitlement. Republicans didn't pay for any of it. Paul Ryan voted for all of it. On top of that, they left behind an economy in free fall. So when President Obama took office, the Republicans handed him the bill. Projected deficits of trillions of dollars. Congressman Ryan, America is literally in your debt. So President Obama went to work. He established a bipartisan commission to get smart folks from both parties together to develop a plan to reduce the deficit and to grow jobs. And guess what? It worked. They produced a balanced bipartisan plan that would cut $4 trillion from the deficit. You know, lots of Republicans voted for it, including Senator Coburn from Oklahoma. And Paul Ryan was on that commission. He voted against the plan. And last week, Paul Ryan criticized the president for not acting on the bipartisan plan that he himself opposed. Then he said President Obama doesn't have a plan to reduce the deficit. But the president does have a plan. Here it is, right here in my hand. The president submitted this plan to the Congress. It's on the internet. President Obama's plan uses the bipartisan commission's balanced approach. It reduces the deficit by more than $4 trillion, cutting spending and asking those at the top to pay the same rates they did under President Clinton. When we created nearly 23 million jobs and balanced the budget. So when Paul Ryan told America that President Obama didn't have a plan, that was false. The truth is, he and Mitt Romney just don't like the president's plan. They pledged that they would never ask millionaires to pay one more dime to reduce our deficit. Mitt Romney even said he would reject a budget with $10 in spending cuts for every $1 in new revenue. And now a third grader can do the math. If you refuse to ask the wealthiest to pitch in, then you hit everybody else much harder. And that's exactly what the Romney-Ryan plan does. You know, they call their plan brave, bold, courageous. I ask all of you, is it bold to give millionaires another tax cut while forcing seniors to pay more for Medicare? No. Is it brave to reward companies that ship jobs overseas while cutting education here at home? And is it courageous to raise taxes on middle-class families while giving tax cuts to people with Swiss bank accounts? Look.
And we've been listening to Chris Van Hollen, a congressman from Maryland, criticizing Paul Ryan's budget proposals, saying they would hurt the less well-off and be a boon to the better-off. Coming up, we've got Elizabeth Warren, a congressional candidate in Massachusetts, and former President Bill Clinton headlining tonight's Democratic National Convention. This is live special coverage from NPR News.